Hello everyone, thanks for watching. For our latest Artemis Live video interview, I'm delighted to be speaking with Christian Mumenthaler, the CEO of global reinsurer Swiss Re. Christian, it's great to see you again. I hope all's well.
All well, thanks. Great to speak to you again.
Yes, it's been a year since we last spoke. It always tends to be this time of year. I wonder why. And at that time, the reinsurance market was beginning to firm. And this is something that's really accelerated significantly since then. And obviously, there's a lot going on in the world. And at the same time, Swiss Re has been building out activities in insurance and securities. And that's accelerated quite significantly since then as well. So there's a backdrop to all of this of volatility, weather, climate and catastrophe losses, the lingering pandemic, and more prominently in 2022, what was a developing inflationary environment is now accelerating really quickly, and capital markets remain highly unpredictable at the moment, it seems. So there's really a lot to discuss. I thought we'd dive right in to discuss reinsurance market conditions to begin, if that's okay with you. So Christian, the mid-year renewals are now over, and we saw some really significant rate hardening in some quarters. How was the market in your view, and do you see developments as positive enough?
Yeah, Steve, you probably have seen the results of all the reinsurers. Some significant price increases were achieved, but vice versa, inflation has eaten up a lot of that. I would say the combination of inflation and adapted models, in particular in the NatCat side, but also in other places, has sort of neutralized these price increases by and large when you look across. So in our own case, it's plus 6%, but also plus 6% in expected loss. And the reason we have 1 point better in the combined ratio is only because we had some portfolio shifts, which led to that. And then obviously you have some benefit from the higher interest rates. So that from an economic point of view, plays a role. But fundamentally, it is all the increases are being eaten up by real life issues.
Yeah, that's really interesting as well, because it's perhaps been glossed over a little bit, quite how significant the sort of increase in burden has become because of this inflation. And I guess that leads me on to my next thought is, what are your expectations for the end of the year? We're just moving up towards the Monte Carlo rendezvous. And obviously, at this time of year, everybody begins their discussions around renewals, both reinsurance and retrocession. But what are your expectations, both in terms of the potential for additional hardening, but also how do you think the negotiation process is going to go?
Yeah, I think there's different factors. Right? I think the first factor is for many years now, the reinsurers have really done their job. They have insulated primary insurance from huge shocks over several years. But of course, over time, reinsurers also need to earn their cost of capital. So there's a very, very strong need to come back to a profitable territory and get to a sustainable level over time, including the bad years. So I think that's one element. Then the overall geopolitical macroeconomic situation is extremely tough. It's extremely difficult. Risks are abundant. There's a lot of uncertainty from the war here in Europe. Higher inflation means pressure on reserves and on the new business also. Some primary companies struggle to increase the prices as much as needed because of regulatory constraints. So I think the backdrop is a really challenging backdrop. And we're going to see insurers fundamentally buying the same or more because of inflationary pressure. So just the value going up and needing to buy more. Plus, reinsurance has really worked well the last few years. And on the reinsurance side, you could see that certain players are retreating somewhat from the NatCat markets. So I would definitely expect hardening to continue in a significant way, without having a crystal ball, obviously, of what's really going to happen by then. It's going to be influenced by everything that's going to happen in the world until end of the year.
Yeah, no, there's such a lot going on at the moment, and as you said, there's always the wild cards of NatCat events and things like that, which could change the dynamic even more by 1-1. You mentioned NatCat risk and the retreat that some reinsurers have been sort of going through recently. Now, this is something I wanted to ask you about, because Swiss Re's maintained its appetite and in fact perhaps increased it a little bit, unlike some of the competitors. But is this something you expect will continue? And I guess alongside that, how important do you see the role of reinsurers in absorbing catastrophe volatility as being?
So I think it's one of the core lines. It's one of the biggest needs of our clients to absorb the NatCat risk. And it's one of the raison d'être for reinsurance in the first place. There's different components again to that. I think one is we have been active in the field for a very long time. We have in-house models for all kinds of NatCat perils. We have 30 to 50 people working on these models and researchers. And we have a good track record overall. Of course, some of the last few years were very challenging, but we have a very good track record. And we try to adapt and bring the climate change induced higher level of losses and secondary perils into our models. But we have confidence in the models. I think that's the first point. Then the other point is really, it depends on your balance sheet, how profitable the business is. In our last investor day, there was one very interesting slide where we for ourselves looked at what kind of return would we have if we were a pure NatCat player, what if we were a pure P&C player, and what return do we have now? So on a pure NatCat basis, on our regulatory system, SST and all of that, it would be 6% return. So it's clearly not sufficient. If we had only the P&C lines, it would be 12%, which is covering cost of capital, but not stellar. And with life and health and everything else, we get to 26% return. So on a highly diversified balance sheet like Swiss Re, in the regulatory system we are, which takes care of all this diversification, it's a highly attractive line of business for our shareholders. But you can understand that this is not necessarily the case for everybody else in the market. And so I think it's entirely explainable and rational why different players would have different reactions and different strategies around that.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's a very good point about the diversification there. And obviously with the improving performance potential within elements like corporate solutions as well, I expect you're better positioned than perhaps you were a few years ago as well to deliver those returns across the cycle. All of this ties in nicely into alternative capital and insurance and securities as well. And obviously at Swiss Re, these are important business segments. But I mean, how important are they in your view as the company looks to continue playing this important role for clients in terms of absorbing catastrophe and also climate exposures?
As you know, I'm a bit biased because I used to lead that team, so I'm very passionate about that. And at the beginning, the years 2001, I took over until 2003, and there were no investors at the time. So this was a very, very different time, and we were all trying to get investors into it. And now it's obviously a very different situation. But why? You know, there's this huge protection gap in the world. A lot is in the NatCat space, so it's really gigantic. And it's clear that fundamentally, if this was to be closed, if we want to close this, reinsurers cannot take it. It's already peak risk for our reinsurers' balance sheet. We're at the limit. And therefore, from a societal point of view, you need to find a solution. And capital markets, I think, for this particular risk are extremely well suited. The history has proven us right in that. And so to make sure there is an influx of capital from capital markets for this type of risk makes a ton of sense. And we really see this as a win-win-win situation. So our clients get access to capacity, and then investors going through us have access to our knowledge and access to the risk. And we for ourselves can make additional earnings by taking on more risk, which we then share with our investors. So I think it's a system that's extremely solid because it makes deep economic sense.
Mm. Yeah, you've sort of expanded the way you use alternative capital sources on both sides of the business, I guess, this year or over the last 12 months. One notable piece of news was your sort of hybrid stop loss transaction, which clearly displayed the appetite of capital markets to back your underwriting. How pleased were you with that transaction, and how significant an initiative do you think that could have been for you?
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic transaction. Obviously, the team was able to basically it's a tail risk on the underwriting side that was transferred through a transaction of more than a billion size, and it was well received by capital markets. It was done with JP Morgan, who found investors. The junior tranche was oversubscribed, so it clearly found a market. And for us, it's an efficient tool, especially on the S&P and SST capital side. It works for in both regimes. So it's a really interesting, innovative transaction that our team was able to make. And we see this as support or external validation for our underwriting quality, that investors are willing to take this tail risk.
Yeah, and to take it in that volume as well is really quite impressive. And obviously you have other instruments on that side as well, like catastrophe bonds and your long-standing sidecar platform. But on the other side of the business, where you're now managing capital for ILS investors as well, you've now got two dedicated units, a new cat bond focus manager launched in recent weeks. So what sort of prospects do you see for these fund management initiatives?
You see, this is all developed over time, and it's all in the same strategy and spirit, to basically leverage our knowledge and our access to clients, to the risk, but to share it with capital markets. And different capital market players have different needs. And so for a very long time, more than 20 years, they could invest in cap bonds when we issue cap bonds, so single peril cap bond. And then what came on top is then our sidecar, so people can invest in our cat portfolio as is, which we share, which we do for ourselves, but they can share proportionally and therefore really profit from our underwriting capabilities. And then this new initiative is really interesting, is a new initiative, but on a very old fund, because at the beginning, 20 years ago, we started to trade cat bonds because it was a necessary feature for a market to exist. Investors needed to know, even though we don't give any guarantees, so we're not market makers, but they can come to Swiss Re and sell a bond if they need to, or also look for a supply. And so it was a bit of a warehouse that we had for a long time. You can imagine that it has performed extremely well, because when people come and sell a bond, typically it's not a very liquid market. They're very happy to get a price. Sometimes also under strained circumstances where a hurricane is approaching, and our team can make an assessment of what we think the price is, and then vice versa, if people really need a bond to increase, they're willing to pay a slightly higher price. So as this has performed really well, and we have given more and more and more capacity, and it's grown to a significant size in-house, the idea was, it was not a big stretch to say, well, why don't we give external investors also access to this sort of traded cat bond portfolio. And so this is the latest step, which is maybe attractive for another type of institutional investor.
So you're now providing lots of different entry points for investors, which is I think particularly positive for the future. And thinking about the future, and while we stick on the ILS market for a moment, how do you feel it's been recovering after the recent challenging years? And do you think we could be set for a period of growth for ILS going forwards?
I think it's a healthy market. It goes through also cycles. There was maybe a bit of a craziness a few years ago where people went in. I mean, the people who were stuck to the original cap bonds, they did well over all this time. And again, this year, right, cap bonds proved their value. They're not correlated to the rest of the market. But of course, there was this push into lower layers and actually more reinsurance or structured reinsurance, collateralized reinsurance, where it's not really the original cap bond idea anymore. It's much more in the money, and there people have lost quite a bit of money, like reinsurers, by the way, of course, everybody has. But I think it's in a really healthy state. So there's still lots of professionals in it. The returns have been okay this year, is around zero, but it is zero not because of losses, it's zero because of the widening of spreads, because people anticipate a hardening in the reinsurance market. So the zero has to be seen as a good sign for the future health of the market. And as I said before, it has shown a decoupling with financial markets generally, which proved the whole point of the value of this market. The issuance first half year was $8 billion, which is the third biggest year ever. So I think the ILS market is in a good shape and maturing, going through cycles and maturing more and more.
Yeah, and it's interesting how that zero actually is really quite significant this year when everything else is so far down in the markets. And I wanted to turn to the broader sort of macro environment. It's challenging for people, for businesses around the world. How impactful do you think the inflationary environment is going to be for insurance and reinsurance companies?
Yeah, it's very difficult to say exactly where this is going to go. I think the consensus in economists, including ours, is that inflation will be tamed. Our expectation is that by 2024, beginning 2024, we're back to 2%. So it will take time to bring it down, but this is the expectation at this stage. And that inflation will be structurally higher than pre-COVID. That 2%, right, that's actually higher. And that it would stay for a longer time. And that's because you have some fundamental, you know, challenges in the world. You have the decoupling of some of the world. You have the reshoring or nearshoring of value chains. You have the transition on the carbon side, on the energy system side, etc. So I think there's a lot of sort of strategic factors that will favor inflation in the next 2 years. So, I mean, it basically means you have to price it. Price for risk goes up. The flip side of all of that is, or the positive side is interest rates, of course. Our reinvestment rate last year was 0.9%. Now it's 3%. So that's an enormous difference that will, of course, take time to eat itself into the overall bond holdings you have as a company over a few years. But it's going to have a very positive effect.
Mm. Yeah, you made a very good point there that a lot is changing still in the way society operates, and I think that with the pandemic and then this sudden burst of inflation, it's certainly going to take a while to tame, but also it may never get back to the low levels that we previously saw. That may just be a new normal, I expect. I'd also like to really hear your view as to how insurers and reinsurers can drive home the importance of their protection for communities and people at this time, a time when perhaps people are feeling more financially pressured, but insurance perhaps is more important than ever for a lot of them.
Well, I would think that if you look at the last few years, the industry has performed really well for consumers. It struggled to get the right returns for shareholders, but for consumers, it has worked really well. And I mean, the insurance and reinsurance sector has acted as a shock absorber for COVID and for all these NatCats, for all the flooding, for all the things that happened in the world. You can see that in a higher risk awareness of the general population. So some products are popular, and I think I know that insurance is not always popular, and it always needs, you know, education about risk and what it means. But I would think that in times like these, the industry has proven its worth and how it makes the world more resilient, and that people can generally see it.
Mm, yeah, and I expect the upshot will be more demand over time. And finally, we really need to mention climate change. It's such a hot topic still within the industry. But how do you feel reinsurers are doing on this? I mean, risk transfer, critical component of the climate transition, mitigation and protection sort of initiatives around the world. But could the industry be doing more, do you think? Is it doing enough yet?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of components to that. Obviously, the first thing is that the industry was one of the first industries to warn around climate change and talk about it. Now that it's, I think, accepted broadly and people see it, certainly the broader population can see it nearly everywhere in the world where we are. The question is, how do we transition the world into this net zero? A lot of insurers and reinsurers, I have to say, mostly European ones, have been at the forefront of making the pledges, of acting upon it. So they're part of the Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance, for example. So that's an alliance of enormous amount of assets that have all pledged to be net zero by 2050, which means they are currently putting pressure where their shareholders, where their bondholders, on companies. And this is probably the single biggest effect I can see in this whole climate change debate, is that all the companies, whatever sector you are, feel the heat and feel the support from shareholders, from a strong shareholder base. We are one of the most attractive shareholders because we can be very long term. So this is changing people's minds. This means that more and more companies are joining the fight. And once companies go at it, they can do enormous amounts of, you know, internal savings, restructuring their value chains, investing in new technologies to get green. It's I think it's entirely feasible. It's just a huge, huge effort. And it will happen because we have now network effects that will reinforce it, and it will go down on that path. And that includes also Asia, and I think also the US will follow, hopefully. And so in that race down, you also need insurance and reinsurance as investors in infrastructure projects and wind farms, solar farms, entities to capture CO2 from the atmosphere and put it to the ground, et cetera, et cetera. So, but we are, right? The insurance and reinsurance industry, maybe invisibly, but is involved in all of these projects. There's no project that's not insured in the world. And we are strongly encouraging this transition. And then our underwriting will come on top. So the underwriting is not just the asset side. The underwriting is a bit more complex. But through our underwriting, we also encourage people to go down net zero, because we will ultimately only be able to underwrite people, companies that have pledged to be net zero by 2050.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, and that's obviously an increasingly hot topic everywhere, the ESG component of underwriting within the industry. Christian, really appreciate your time today. It's been really great to talk to you and get your updated views on things. And it sounds like everything's going well at Swiss Re. Hopefully I might see you in Monte Carlo, but if not, I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.